You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Susan Lee, thanks so much for joining SBS.
It's a pleasure.
Back in 2021, I want to read a quote from you. You said, I want to get to net zero as quickly as possible. What's changed your conviction?
The realities that we're facing right now, and that's why our plan is about what Australians deserve: affordable energy and responsible emissions reduction. But we're going to prioritise affordable energy, because what we're seeing is prices going up, reliability going down, and emissions flatlining. So the government has got every aspect of its energy policy wrong. And importantly, it's not addressing emissions in a way that recognises the challenge that we all understand is there. We're part of the Paris Agreement still. But the fact is that while Australians are struggling with 40% increases in their power bills, we've got a Prime Minister who promised them that electricity prices were going to come down for two elections in a row. So we're responding to a really urgent challenge in the Australian economy and massive, massive failures from this government.
So to be clear, the majority of your party room was in favour of ditching net zero, and you personally are in favour of ditching net zero in its entirety.
I am 100% committed to the plan that I'm talking about today that was signed off by our entire party room and indeed the whole opposition yesterday. This is a plan that backs in Australians who right now are being let down by a government that's pushing up their costs of energy 40% for household bills, 40% for gas. Meanwhile, and I spend a lot of time on manufacturing factory floors, I was on one this morning, we're not making things in Australia anymore. We're offshoring the manufacturing that has been so important to Australia. Energy is the economy. And when we do that, we don't reduce emissions for the planet. Things are just being made somewhere else and then they're being imported here. That's one of the reasons why my focus for responsible emissions reduction looks at what sort of future the next generation, Generation Z and millennials, are going to inherit if they have a lower standard of living than their parents.
Now, with every strategy document, there is a political strategy. So which Labor and Teal seats are you going to win with that document?
Everywhere. Everywhere in Australia, I will be taking this message, as will my team, because it doesn't matter where you live in this country. You don't want the next generation to inherit debt. You want them to inherit opportunity. And when we look at the failures of this government and we see those energy costs rising, I know that Australians don't want to live in a country where everything that we need to build houses, to grow food, to live the lifestyle that we need to, is not being made here because of a punishing mechanism called the safeguard mechanism that this Labor Party is putting on businesses and industries, that's pushing the manufacture of products offshore, and it's not doing anything to support emissions coming down globally.
So despite the polls, despite the advice from your failed Liberal candidates who had to, you know, pound the pavement, knock on the doors and told you that net zero was something that mattered to those communities, you honestly believe you could win, you know, enough seats to govern, you know, 30 seats on the basis of this policy?
Look, it's important that when we say the words net zero, we interrogate what that means to different people. I speak to young people, and I said when I became leader, I was going to meet modern Australia where they are, and I have, including young people, including mums who didn't vote for us at the last election. And when I talk to them about what net zero means, you get a range of answers. But for many, it's the reassurance that we can give with this plan that we do want to play our role responsibly with emissions reduction. And we will, by reducing emissions year on year in line with comparable countries and as fast and as far as technology will allow. And I talk to people about that and they understand that by making those statements as part of our plan, by staying within the Paris Agreement, and by demonstrating that we want the economy to be strong. Because remember, if you don't have a strong economy, you actually can't look after your environment. When I was Environment Minister, I was able to find $1 billion for the reefs and catchment of the Great Barrier Reef. And that was because we were running a strong economy and we were able to protect our environment.
So which climate scientists and economists did you consult to come to this policy position?
The facts. So let me give you the facts that Labor is...
But which climate scientists or economists individually did did you consult or bring on board to help you frame the policy?
Well, the policy is framed by our response to what Labor is doing. But when you talk about climate science, I don't reject the climate science, and that's why we have a responsible pathway to emissions reduction, and that's why we're part of the Paris Accord. This is not about rejecting climate science. The economics are all around us. And I just want to give you to capture what Labor's net zero by 2050 means, according to Labor. So they've said it means 82% of our electricity grid will be renewable by 2030. That's in just 5 years' time. Now, everyone knows that's impossible. Right now, 43% of the grid is renewable. If we were to get to 82% in 5 years, I mean, even the best economists that I have quoted in my report and climate experts say the biggest number is probably around 58%. So Labor has said that 82% renewable target is there to demonstrate the 43% reduction that they have presented in reduced emissions for 2030. So their whole plan has fallen apart already with just those simple facts, because we know what we're seeing around us now. But we know that the grid can't cope with the number of renewables without sufficient baseload and dispatchable power to balance renewables. I'm not against renewables. They absolutely are in the plan, in the right place. But the transition is being mismanaged, and that's why we're seeing prices skyrocket. Affordability has to, therefore, be front and centre.
You have some of the most respected energy experts in Australia make an assessment of this policy document and say renewables are not driving up power prices, that it's international volatility, the war in Ukraine, that it's also the ageing coal-fired power stations.
Well, 60%
Why are they wrong?
60% of power in the eastern states is provided by coal. That's true. And don't worry, state governments are extending the life of coal-fired power stations. Now, they could turn them off if renewables could do the job, but they can't. And the reason they can't is because the cost of building the transmission grid for renewables. So the renewables themselves are relatively inexpensive, because we're talking about the sun, the wind, and the capture in the location where the solar farm is or the wind farm is. But it's the transmission of those renewable electricity to a power system that is incredibly expensive. It's the transmission infrastructure, it's the synchronous condensers, because they don't have a big, heavy inertia, the inertia of a spinning turbine. You have to build that synchronicity into a renewable grid. A lot of that equipment is highly specialised, comes from overseas, has a 12 to 36 month waiting time, and of course is adding massive cost. And if you talk to anyone who's waiting to invest in a renewable energy project in Australia, they'll tell you that they are years and years behind. If you go into my part of the world, you know that I come from Western New South Wales, you can see how far behind the build of that renewable energy infrastructure is. And I'll be quite honest, how unpopular it is in parts of Australia, which is why we've said we'll put communities first and have social licence around this.
And how much will taxpayers be underwriting coal-fired power stations into the future? Are you talking in the hundreds of millions of dollars?
I'm talking about the need to balance the grid with reliable baseload power, which may include coal, which can include gas.
To what expense, though?
So this isn't about the government expending the money. This is about the market stepping in and doing what the market needs to for reliable generation. So we're not dictating the grid. Obviously, AEMO manages the grid and has called out massive gaps in reliability in every single state. Now, that reliability can only be filled by baseload power. So coal does need to stay in the system a bit longer. That's why state governments are extending the life of coal-fired power stations, because when you bring renewables into the system, they can't do it all on their own.
And the taxpayers deserve to know, Susan Lee, how much you would be prepared, if you were elected Prime Minister, to put forward to pay for the continuation of coal-fired power generation.
Well, taxpayers deserve to know what their energy bills are going to be and whether the grid is reliable and sustainable and can actually deliver the power that they expect. The first job of any government is to make sure that its citizens have affordable power. because we don't want a situation in this country like we saw on the Iberian Peninsula, where we had blackouts from a totally almost an overload of renewables in the operation of the grid. So this is not about intervention. This is about us saying we need to expand supply. So this is a capacity mechanism or the capacity investment scheme that this government has. It's about expanding supply. Now, right now, they've said the only projects they'll underwrite are renewables and batteries. The problem is that the grid really does need baseload and dispatchable power. So we're saying we would add those forms and be completely technology neutral. We're not picking winners here. We're not saying we must have this or we must have that.
But coal becomes a part of the discussion again, something that coal is ruled out.
Can I tell you, coal is already part of the discussion, with 60% of the electricity grid being supplied by coal on the East Coast. And those assets...
What does that mean for your relationship with Pacific neighbours? Because they have been very clear about the importance of net zero. Today you were talking about the COP process. You've also spoken about net zero in a way that Pacific nations have said that quite clearly they're very upset about the potential for Australia to go in a direction away from net zero. Are you prepared to sort of put those relationships in a more precarious security situation?
Well, I value the relationship that we have with the Pacific, but I also note that the Pacific has very good relationships with some of the world's largest emitters, including China and the US.
So you don't buy that that's something that could affect our security arrangements?
I just note that the Pacific has good relationships with two of the world's largest emitters, the US and China. And I saw Penny Wong talking about this, and I don't know why the Prime Minister is papering over the failures of his energy policy with this sort of discussion. That's not what this is about. What this is about is making sure that Australians have affordable energy and that we do play our part responsibly in reducing emissions. But energy in this country is not affordable, Anna. And I remember as a young mum worrying about how I was going to pay my bills. And I talk to young mums all the time. And in the lead up to Christmas, you know, there's a lot of expenses. You've got to get it right with the presents and the family and the meals. And if there's trips to the doctor involved, how do you balance all of these things within an increasingly constrained family budget? In fact, young people have said that their biggest concern now is cost of living. And why wouldn't it be when the cost of living is skyrocketing? Now, I just want to say that comes back to energy, because energy is at the heart of everything. And if energy is unaffordable, everything is unaffordable.
Your next battle will be on migration policy. How soon will we see that policy?
You're describing it as a battle. It's not a battle. It's an important discussion that we need to have.
Your next battleground within your party.
I simply reject this battleground characterisation.
Okay, let's ask this question then. Do you believe, like some of your colleagues, that Australia is dealing with mass migration?
I've said that the numbers in the migration intake are too high.
But do you agree with that rhetoric, mass migration?
I've said that the numbers of migrants is too high. Now, people can use whatever terminology they choose. But I want to give you a statistic because that's important. The 10-year average of migrants in what we call the NOM is 100,000 higher than it was. Let me rephrase that. The last figures we got in March 25 showed that a 315,000 figure in the nominal overseas migration number is 100,000 higher than the 10-year average prior to COVID. So my point is that the number is too high and the infrastructure in this country is struggling. So we need to bring the number down. I've said that the great work that's being done by Paul Scar, Senator Paul Scar, and now joining the Home Affairs portfolio, John O'Dunham, the two of them, they're working on foundational principles that will underpin the policy that I will talk about in further detail. And those principles will be out before Christmas, because it's important we address the concerns of Australians. But I want to make this really clear, because I know many migrant communities are part of your viewing audience, as are many that, like me, while being a migrant, I'm not a recent migrant to Australia. So this is not the fault of any migrant or migrant community. These are failings of infrastructure. So when we talk to communities about finding a house, finding a school, finding a place in a hospital, the daily commute, the pressures of public transport in some of our cities, and you know the struggles of roads that are just, quite frankly, not up to scratch, we know that the failings of infrastructure mean that we are out of balance. The numbers of migrants coming into Australia is out of balance with the infrastructure that needs to be provided to support them. So let's have a conversation about that. The government hasn't given us any information about its future numbers, about its strategy, about anything at all.
The numbers that I've also looked at today show that there's been a 40% fall in migration since the post-COVID rebound, when net migration fell into negative numbers. It remains cumulatively lower than what was projected before the COVID pandemic. And from speaking to people across the country in the election campaign, migrants felt responsible for the housing crisis. They felt alienated by Peter Dutton's policy. So why would you go there again?
Net overseas migration is 100,000 higher than it was pre-COVID on a 10-year average. So, I'm not sure what statistic you're using. You might be using some permanent migration statistics or some subset of the migrant, different types of migration to Australia. So we're not going back to any earlier policy. We're simply saying we're developing a policy now that recognises the constraints on infrastructure for Australia's migrant communities. But when I meet them, as I do frequently, and Senator Paul Scar and I meet them together all over Australia, I always make it clear that we value the choice that you made as migrants to come to Australia. I'm very grateful for the choice that my parents made as migrants to come to Australia in the mid-1970s, and incredibly grateful for what this beautiful country has given me. And for migrants who've chosen to come here, they build amazing communities and futures for their children, and that's something that we value highly.
The fact that the 5% cut that Peter Dutton was pursuing?
You're talking about old policy? I'm talking about developing new policy.
And so when we look at the different visa categories, will the visa category for uni students be affected?
Well, we need to look at all of that, and that's why I said that we'll have something more to say about the principles that will underpin our migration policy before the end of the year.
Backpackers be off limits, though, because we know the Nationals are very keen on backpackers, and you seem to want to find common ground with them.
What I'd like to say is that this needs to be coordinated. It needs to recognise the value of people who come here on temporary visas, on permanent visas, on skilled visas, our humanitarian intake, which is something we take seriously and responsibly, a family reunion intake, and of course students at different educational institutions. So they're all part of the picture. We don't know what Labor's plan is, so we can't respond to it because they're not giving us their plan, but we will work on more detail, which we'll present before the end of the year. So it's coming.
Will it be another Liberal Party room meeting where everyone has a say and it's a majority decision based on consensus? Mm-hmm. Is that how this policy will be decided?
Liberal Party policy is always formed in the Liberal Party party room, and the Nationals do their own thing in their own party room, and that's the approach we've had. But as a coalition, the policy committees that we're working with at the moment, and that is everyone in both teams, meet regularly on a range of different policy areas, not just migration, not just energy, but a whole range of policy areas that are important. Because when I became leader, I said that our policies are up for review, our values are not. You've seen us land an important and necessary energy policy. And can I tell you, I've also talked about two other critical areas of policy. One is how we manage the budget responsibly within our means. I've made a statements about that, to step back from what I see as a culture of dependency, and I want to energise Australians to contribute. I want the private sector to be involved, and I want to see small business flourish. I've also talked about a plan to bring substantial tax cuts for low and middle income earners to the next election. I've also talked about a fairer workplace, tackling some of the industrial relations changes that this government has made that actually aren't in the interests of either employers or employees. And we have to get that right. We're tackling that as well. And I want safer communities, because as I travel around, unfortunately, I meet too many victims of crime. And I'm making an important national security speech speech about national security and defence on Thursday this week. So there's lots going on in the policy space, rest assured.
Susan Lee, there certainly is, and there's also a lot of internal discussion about your future. Some of your moderate colleagues behind the scenes are saying that they are no longer supportive of you. Have you got the numbers in the party room to continue as opposition leader?
Well, some of those reports that you've just referred to are not correct, and I point you to the statements of those colleagues made today subsequent to that.
Two of your colleagues have certainly come out and said that they back you, and they've pushed back against that rhetoric. But other members of your party room, your backers and the moderates, they haven't come out to do interviews. They haven't disputed that story. So my question is, do you have the numbers in your party room to continue as leader?
Well, these are statements that you're making, which, with respect to commentary about commentary, and I'm just not going to be distracted for one single moment from my sole focus, which is talking to Australians about the need for affordable energy. Australians deserve affordable energy, about the really massive failures of this government when it comes to giving them what they said they would to elections, $275 reduction in power prices. In fact, they've gone up by $1,300. So I realise that interviewers will ask me these questions about commentary and speculation and stories, but they're not my focus. This is my sole focus.
Stripping away the speculation, though, my question is, do you think you have the support in the Liberal Party room to continue as opposition leader?
Yes, and the support that we all gave to this plan just yesterday is a demonstration of our unity of purpose when it comes to something that is vital for every single Australian. Energy is the economy.
So what is your message then to those who are picking up the phone, speaking to journalists, who are trying to tear the first woman to be at the helm of the Liberal Party down?
I'm not going to comment on anonymous contributions, speculation and resulting media stories. I honestly am not, because my sole focus is on delivering for the Australian people, delivering a serious, credible, compelling policy agenda by the next election. I've just talked about some of the policies and the principles that are underpinning what we will develop further going forward, the most important one being energy, but I hope you saw there was plenty more besides.
Your very close Liberal colleague, Maria Kovacic, has openly said she's frustrated you haven't gotten the clear air to prosecute your policy agenda as the first woman to lead the party. How difficult has that been for you?
Can I say it's been a terrific day talking about our plan, and I've talked about the other things that, you know, matter to Australians and the Australian economy. I'd make the observation that when people see politicians talking about themselves, they don't necessarily rate that very highly. And I'm really pleased that yesterday we signed off on something that we are all talking about passionately and with purpose.
Does it hurt you though, when you've got that kind of commentary in the background, people criticising you?
It's not really about me. I don't see it that way. I see great responsibility and honour in the job that I have as Liberal Party leader. I always have. I see Australians that are struggling, and whatever happens inside the Canberra bubble, in the commentary and speculation of some reports, I mean, excluding SBS, which everyone is dedicated to, but, you know, some of these other reports are a little bit beltway. I just don't focus on that, because when I'm out there talking to mums, calling into small businesses, standing on manufacturing factory floors, you know, I feel the struggle that ordinary Australians are experiencing, and that gives me determination and strength to fight for them.
Susan Lee, thank you very much for your generous time.
Thank you.